The number of monarch butterflies wintering in Mexico has been declining for 20 years. But in recent years, the summer monarch count in Iowa has stayed pretty steady. New research explains the discrepancy. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. We'll start off the hour with the answer to that monarch mystery and an update on this beloved species. I'll talk with ecologist John Pleasance and entomologist Donald Lewis of Iowa State University. Then, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will join the conversation, and he and Donald will answer your plant and insect questions. 866-780-9100. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and later this hour, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron will be here to answer your plant questions. But we're going to start the hour with the monarch butterfly. For the past 20 years, the populations of monarchs counted in the winter territory in Mexico has been pretty steadily declining. Many Iowans have responded with efforts to plant milkweed to support this beautiful species, but summer counts of monarchs in Iowa and surrounding states seem to be painting a much more optimistic picture for monarchs. John Pleasance, an adjunct assistant professor of ecology, evolution, and organismal biology at Iowa State University, set out to figure out why the numbers weren't adding up. He recently published his study, and he is with me now. Hello, John.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
Donald Lewis is also here, professor of entomology at Iowa State University. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity.
So, John, I want to start with you. Donald and I have talked about monarch butterflies on this program many times. The projected outlook for this beautiful species is not good. For the last 20 years, we have seen these populations pretty steadily declining. What were the numbers that you were seeing that seemed to contradict that?
So over the last two decades, when we count up the monarchs in Mexico, we don't count them one by one, but count the area that they cover when they're up in the trees, we've seen about an 80% decline in those numbers over the last two decades. But people have been surveying butterflies in the summertime for two decades as well, and those numbers are fairly flat. They haven't shown this decline. So there's this discrepancy between these two counts. And this is kind of puzzling because there's a lot of evidence that the loss of milkweeds in the summertime breeding area is responsible for this decline. So why aren't we seeing this decline when we look at these butterfly surveys in the summertime?
Absolutely. And you mentioned that in the winter survey, people are counting the area that the monarchs cover.
Right.
So
right.
That makes it fairly easy to at least compare the numbers from year to year, whether they are exactly accurate or not. How do we count them in the summertime? Because they're spread out.
Right. So in the summertime, you can't count all the butterflies that are out there. And anytime we ecologists sample populations to look at how populations change over time, we're sampling a portion of the population. We have certain areas that we go to, and we count the numbers there, and we assume that those are reflective over time of changes in the population as a whole. And this is the key point. This is what we point out in this paper, is that these surveys of butterflies are done in natural areas, as you would expect, parks and other kinds of areas, but they're not done in agricultural fields. And the key thing that's happened over the last two decades is that monarch activity has shifted out of agricultural fields into these non-agricultural areas where the censuses are made. So two decades ago, almost 80% of all monarch activity was in agricultural fields, and now it's virtually all outside of these fields. So the counts that were made in these non-agricultural areas, there's a confounding factor. So they were they were measuring something about the population size, but they were also including this shift of monarch activity out of agricultural fields.
Well, and not even necessarily a shift, but those monarchs that people are seeing in these natural areas, they would have been there before, but
yes.
There's this absence of monarchs in agricultural areas.
Right, right. So these censuses in non-agricultural areas are, at one time, two decades ago, would have seen just a small proportion of the population, and now they're seeing basically all that there is.
So that brings the numbers into alignment. That's certainly not good news.
Right. So what this does is it, there was some doubt cast on the narrative that the loss of milkweeds in the summertime was driving the decline. And so some researchers have been very adamant that, no, it's much more complex than that. But when we remove this confounding factor of shifting proportions, we find that the population in the summer declines in lockstep with the decline for the overwintering population. So what that does is it tells us, yes, it's the loss of milkweeds that's responsible, and yes, all these efforts by many, many people to go out and try to put milkweeds on the landscape, that's a good thing. It has a sound scientific basis.
The effort to plant milkweed around the state in people's yards, people are trying to plant them in ditches. They used to, of course, when I was a kid, they were in all the ditches as well as in the farm fields, and they've been disappearing from ditches on rural roads as well. So this effort to bring the milkweeds back, it would be impossible, it sounds like, to counteract the fact that we have all of this land in production that used to be dotted with milkweed.
Right. So Bob Hartzler in the agronomy department did some very key surveys about two decades ago and more recently. So we kind of have an idea of what the numbers are. And so we've lost about 3.3 billion milkweed stems from the Midwest, from these agricultural fields. And 50% of agricultural fields in the past would have had milkweeds. They don't have that anymore. So the landscape, which used to be fairly contiguous with milkweeds here and there and everywhere, now is these gaping holes wherever there's an agricultural field.
The efforts to plant milkweed, do they seem to be paying off in some way for the monarchs?
Well, I don't think we can tell right now. Part of the reason is the magnitude of the restoration that's needed is enormous. So I've estimated we need 1.6 billion new milkweed stems in the Midwest just to get the population to a level that we think could be resilient to various kinds of environmental perturbations. So 1.6 billion is a large number. We haven't really achieved anything close to that yet. So it's certainly premature to say our efforts are helping
right.
in any particular way.
Well, so the 30 stems in my yard may make a difference microclimate population.
Well, we've put out a paper recently, which the subtitle is All Hands on Deck. So the question is, okay, we need more milkweeds out there. We need them scattered widely. How do we do that? You mentioned roadsides. That's a key habitat, CRP land, a key habitat. But the All Hands on Deck idea is that every little bit helps. So your 30 plants in your yard, that's a good thing. That helps in some way.
Well, and Donald, I'll bring you into the conversation. Of course, we've been talking about monarchs for many, many years, and the numbers have continued to decline. What are you hearing from people about monarchs in Iowa in the last couple of years?
People comment that they saw one, and you think, gee, it wasn't that long ago, you would have just noticed a dozen or two dozen of them and not even reflected on it at all. And now people see one and they think it's a noteworthy event. So people are concerned, people are watching, people are paying attention. And much of my extension outreach over the last couple of years has been visiting with garden clubs and master gardeners and others about restoring milkweeds and the research that comes out of the Monarch Consortium here at Iowa State University has been useful in identifying that it doesn't have to be just common milkweed. It can be one of the other kinds of milkweeds, and every little bit helps.
Remind me again of why milkweed is so important for this species.
The monarch butterfly is a specialist. She will only lay her eggs on milkweeds, and her caterpillars have co-evolved with milkweeds to the point that the caterpillars require milkweed in order to survive, to grow. That's what they feed on, that's what they metabolize, and that's how they grow from little tiny caterpillars up to big caterpillars and eventually metamorphose into the adult stage. It's a peculiarity of some insects to be specialists. They will only feed on one kind of plant. Other insects, like the Japanese beetle that we just had so much experience with, they're generalists. They will feed on hundreds of different kinds of plants. So it's a different strategy. You can be a specialist and eat one thing all your life. You can be a generalist and eat lots of other things. It turns out both strategies work.
With the disappearance of milkweed from farm fields, this is because of the widespread use of glyphosate. And, of course, we have these crops that are glyphosate resistant, and so it's easy to eradicate all the weeds from a field. Has there been research about how we could possibly try to integrate milkweed into our agricultural environment again?
Well, I don't think anyone's advocating, letting milkweeds be in agricultural fields. But if you start walking around the edges of agricultural fields, you find that that's really a very good environment for milkweeds. It's disturbed habitat. That's what milkweeds like. So field edges, letting your milkweeds live on the edges of fields could be a useful resource.
And people have been making this effort. My husband commented the other day, I know why they call milkweed a weed, because it really does seem to be spreading pretty dramatically, at least in our yard. So do you have advice? I know, Donald, you've been trying to get people to plant milkweed. Do you have advice for people on how to cultivate it, how to spread it?
Well, the nice thing about common milkweed, or maybe it's a two-edged sword, is that it spreads by itself. So some of the milkweeds have vegetative reproduction. The common milkweed is one. So I have some plants in my yard that some milkweeds have popped up, 10 feet away from runners from that particular plant. So common milkweed can spread like that. This is why when we talk about milkweed restoration, it's a very good plant to plant, because you put one in the ground and next year there'll be two, three, and four. And so it spreads by itself. You don't have to put seeds out. Other kinds of milkweeds, butterfly weed, swamp milkweed, those are not vegetatively reproducing, so they'll stay wherever you plant them.
Well, John, so the main takeaway from this research is that the problem is just as serious as we thought it was.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, John, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
John Pleasance is an adjunct assistant professor of ecology, evolution, and organismal biology at Iowa State University. He just published a paper showing his research into why there was a discrepancy between the numbers of monarchs counted in their wintering grounds in Mexico and monarch surveys in Iowa and surrounding states. We will continue our conversation in a moment. Donald Lewis, professor of entomology at Iowa State University, will stay with us. Richard Duran will join us, and they are here to answer your questions about plants and insects. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled, and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. You are welcome to join our conversation with your questions about insects or plants today. We've got Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis here with us today. We've got Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran here today. And you can call 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And let's start off with a couple more questions about monarchs, although, hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here. Here's a question from Donna in Webster City. She says, last week I saw a caterpillar on a milkweed that all the leaves were eaten off of and no other milkweed in sight. I considered moving the caterpillar and stem to another location in my yard where there was milkweed with leaves. Is that a valid idea? How quickly can they move on their own?
They don't move well on their own, but we know they disappear. That you can have you can see a monarch on your milkweed plant, you can watch her lay an egg, you can see that little caterpillar develop, and you go out the next day and it's gone. It could have been subject to predators, or it could have fallen off and wandered away. But I think in clumps of milkweeds, like John Pleasance was describing, they probably do move from plant to plant. But on an isolated plant, where the butterfly laid her egg out of desperation, that caterpillar needs all the resources that it can get in order to grow to that full size, and relocating them is okay.
All right. Much to lose there.
Nothing to lose, and we do this all the time when you find a caterpillar and you bring it into the classroom or you bring it into your mother's kitchen and you put it in a cage and you say, bring in a milkweed leaf every day to feed this caterpillar, and you could get milkweeds, you could get leaves from lots of different plants, and the caterpillars still seem to thrive.
All right, and this is purely anecdotal, but I have noticed that many more of my friends have been doing this in recent years. It seems like raising the awareness of milkweed need and monarch need has also led a lot more people to, when they find a monarch caterpillar, bring it inside to raise it to adulthood. I think some people think that they're protecting them from predation, and maybe they are.
Well, maybe they are, but the educational value of watching the growth of a caterpillar, and then especially watching the metamorphosis from caterpillar to butterfly, that's like watching a miracle happen. And we don't get to see a lot of miracles, although eventually everything seems like a miracle, doesn't it? But it's just such a neat lesson to be able to watch that and see that transformation.
All right, and you're not harming.
No.
Okay.
Nope. Well, essentially, you have to let it go eventually.
Right. That would be a good idea. All right. Here's a question, or a couple questions for you, Richard, from Tyler. He says, I've got a dirt spot around 5 feet long and 3 feet wide between my short front deck, 20 inches tall with no railing, and next to my driveway. This area gets plenty of sun. Would it be a good place for a butterfly bush, or is it too small?
Now, the butterfly bush is actually a woody plant, and it tends to be kind of a sprawling plant, so I would say it's too small.
All right. Any suggestions on what might go in there if he's looking for something shrubby?
Something shrubby. Boy, that's not a very big area for a shrub. Possibly some of the small spireas. The Japanese spireas would possibly be something that works. They're very easy to grow, very adaptable, very tolerant. They like sun, though, so it should be full sun.
All right, and here's his next question. He's all about small spaces. I've got a large boulder in my front yard, which I want to surround with flowers. The boulder is about 3 feet tall. I'd like flowers to come no more than halfway up the boulder. Do you have any suggestions for a low-maintenance perennial flower so that gets no taller than a foot and a half?
Boy, the problem with the perennial plants is they don't bloom all summer long. And so they might have, for example, maybe some creeping phlox. That's a perennial, very low growing. That would provide flowers in the spring. And then they might want to plant maybe some marigolds or petunias as an annual that bloom all summer long.
All right. And here's a question from Steve in Windsor Heights, also one we've heard a lot of this summer. My 6-year-old linden tree has been healthy until this summer. Working from the top of the tree downward, the leaves are being eaten, leaving only the skeletal remains of the leaf. Is there anything I can do to prevent further damage?
Further damage is not likely. The Japanese beetle has come, and in many areas it has gone. But it's been an interesting summer in that there were so many of them back in the 4th of July that I thought we were done for the year. But no, the Japanese beetles made a return in about the third week of July, and we had sort of this second wave of them, except in the north half of the state where it was kind of a permanent wave. So the Japanese beetle has come and largely done what it's going to do. Your linden tree will live. It will be ugly for most of the rest of the summer. Those skeletonized leaves may fall early, so you have less leaf material maybe to rake up in the fall. But there's nothing more you can do other than tender, loving care, which for a mature tree means watering during dry periods and nothing else.
Well, and he said a six-year-old linden tree, so that's pretty young.
That's
so would the watering be even more important?
Yes. Yep. Keep it watered during the dry period all the way up until the soil freezes. But now that we're getting rains here recently, we may be able to put the garden hose away for a little while. But if drought conditions continue or return, watering will be what we can do to protect those trees that have had a severe stress, but not a fatal stress.
All right. You can join the conversation with your questions, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Bob is on the line in Bettendorf. Hi, Bob.
Hello. I've had this problem. I own, I invest in real estate, and I owned an 8-acre tract of land in Moline, and then a number of contiguous empty lots in Davenport. And in both cases, the so-called environmental inspectors from the city have forced me to destroy the milkweed, telling me that it's an environmental hazard. Now,
so
I cannot
like
afford...
A noxious weed is what they're calling
yeah,
it?
Yeah, okay. Right. And... I cannot afford huge legal bills fighting city halls. Is there some kind of a state authority or federal authority that can step in that case and help me?
We're kind of drawing a blank look at each other here in the studio at the moment. The name that comes to mind for me is Weed Commissioner. There should be a weed commissioner for every county, and that could be someone who can mediate these kinds of questions. I know this is not uncommon, that there's this conflict between going natural, as in turning my yard into a prairie, versus the wanting a mowed lawn and not having noxious weeds. The weed commissioner is where I would start, and you could also check with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources to see if there's somebody there who can help you. But I'm not aware of anybody who can immediately step in and take over. What do you think, Richard? Is there a weed person out there?
There should be in each county. Yes, there should be.
Okay, weed commissioner is the name you're looking for.
All right, good luck with that, Bob. Thanks a lot for your call. Kevin's up next in Clarion. Hi, Kevin.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I love the subject on butterflies, but I have a more elementary question for Dr. Richard. It's about tomato varieties.
Okay.
N, V versus V. I'd forgotten what that is and why that is so important for tomatoes.
Okay. Typically, when you see a modern tomato variety or cultivar, you'll see some letters after the name. And V stands for Verticillium wilt, F for Fusarium wilt. And those cultivars are resistant to those two vascular diseases. They're resistant. They're not totally immune, but they're resistant. And then you'll see other letters like N for nematodes. They're not bothered by nematodes. So they basically stand for something, yes.
So when
now I'm glad and more confused. I guess I'll have another question next week. Thank you very much.
But as far as the vascular wilt, it's important that there be resistant because you can't control those diseases using a fungicide. Those are vascular diseases. They enter the plant through the root system. They get into the root system. They plug up the water conducting tissue in the plant. So eventually what happens, the plant wilts and dies. And so the only way to prevent that would be to have something that's resistant to it so you don't get it. That's the hope.
All right. Good luck, Kevin. Thanks a lot for your call. Next, we'll go to Vienna in Fairfield. Hi, Vienna.
Yes. I have a groundhog that is eating up my cucumbers and okra and quite demolishing them. And what I was wondering is, what is the best way to live trap in terms of bait, in terms of placing the trap, and any habits of the groundhog that will help me in understanding how to place it or kind of bait? And will my could my cucumbers and okra return?
Well, I would suggest you contact Adam Jenke here at Iowa State. He is our wildlife extension specialist. Adam Jenke. I believe his phone number is 515-294-1168. Is that correct, Donald?
No, 1168 is forestry, isn't it? Isn't it 1729?
That could be, yes.
You can also look it up online.
Yes.
that would be a good thing rather than guessing. No.
Just dial a bunch and see if you get it.
But trapping is a difficult thing, and sometimes the groundhogs are happier with the cucumbers and the plants than they are going to be with the bait. Will cut-off okra return, though, Richard?
Boy, if it's cut off near the ground, not very likely. Same with cucumbers. If they have destroyed most of the vine, are they going to come back? Probably not, no.
Time to replant? Is there time to replant?
Not with either one, no. With cucumbers, you can plant until about mid-July, so it's too late for those two.
Next year. All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Vienna. Koi is up next in Storm Lake. Hi, Koi.
Good morning. I have several things. Iowa State has been so wonderful about our Master Gardener program here in Storm Lake, so thank them very much. Our garden club planted three kinds of milkweed, and I have to say that the swamp milkweed is very pretty, and so is the butterfly milkweed. And if people are worried about spreading, those two are really pretty in the garden, and you don't have to worry quite so much.
Right.
About
they're attractive plants, and they're well-behaved, and they're fairly easy to grow, too. The butterfly
and they
weed.
Smell wonderful.
Oh yes, the butterfly weed has kind of an orangey red flower, typically kind of orange. Grows about 2 to 3 feet tall. Once you put it in the ground, very low maintenance. It does well in dry to moist situations. Now the swamp or rose milkweed does better in a moist to wet situation.
Of course.
It's a bigger plant. Grows about 3 to 4 feet tall. Again, a very nice, attractive plant. Rose pink flowers, grows about 3 to 4 feet tall. Very, very nice plant, very easy to grow again. So they make very good additions to the landscape.
And I've noticed that they have lots of other insects on them, too, besides the butterflies.
Sure.
At least my regular one did, yeah. Mm-hmm. I have two questions. When can I divide my daylily?
I would probably wait another month and probably do it around early to mid-September.
Okay, about like the iris.
Yeah, you can do it then too, but you can actually do the bearded iris right now.
Typically
do that in midsummer. We typically do things like daylilies in late summer, same with peonies.
Okay. Oh, my peonies look terrible because of the mildew, but
yeah.
I leave them alone. the other thing, I have a taxus, a yew, Nigra Blue John yew, and it's supposed to get quite tall, and I put it out near the street in the shade to cover up a post that the electric people put in, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it had... Oh, I think in June, a little branch that suddenly turned brown. And so I cut it off.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple days later, I had a large branch, and it seemed like overnight turned brown. And now
okay.
I'm afraid to touch it.
Well, that would suggest maybe a canker of some type or possibly a vascular disease. Either way, you cannot do anything to prevent additional dieback. The only thing you can do is to prune out the dead limbs as they appear. That's all you can do.
Okay.
And
that's
basically cross your
do.
Fingers and hope for the best.
Yeah, I hope so, because it's been such a slow grower, too. Oh, my. Okay, thank you very much. I love your program. Don't always get to listen, but I love it very much, Charity. Thank
well,
you.
Well, thanks a lot for your call, Koi. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Here's a question from Mary. She says, will trumpet vine damage my house siding? I was trying to train it over a window for natural shade, but it's covering the siding as well.
I would say definitely yes, it would, or it can.
Mm-hmm. All
it's,
right,
it's a very vigorous plant. It kind of grips on to things, and it's also going to keep it very damp or moist when it rains. So definitely some possible damage, yes.
All right, and good luck fighting back, right?
Well, I would try to get it off if I could, definitely.
Okay. But if you don't really eradicate the vine, it'll come right back.
It will, but you can maybe put it on something to grow on, maybe a trellis away from the house.
All right. Here's her second question. She says, I've got marigolds that reseeded from plants I had planted last year. They're doing so well, I'm thinking of conserving some of the seeds. Will that work for next year?
Sure. Just let the flower heads totally turn brown, and then you can harvest those, carefully tear them apart, put them on a screen to dry, maybe indoors for a few days, maybe a week or two, and then just put them in a packet and store them until spring.
All right, here's a question from Kathy. On Tuesday evening, my husband was watering the Boston ferns on our desk. Suddenly, he was attacked by yellow jackets who evidently had decided to build a nest in one of the ferns. It's about 4 feet wide, 4 feet high. I'd appreciate your advice on whether we need to throw the plant away in case the nest is in the dirt in the pot, or if we can cover the plant with plastic, or what we can do to get the yellow jackets out of there.
Oh, that's a tough question because they've nested in a place where we really can't ignore them, which is always our first choice with wasps and bees. We would like to tolerate them, live and let live, leave them alone. But if it's in this area where we can't do that because of health concerns or stinging concerns, we can treat them. If we know the nest is in that pot, and if we know where they come and go, we can treat that nest opening with a dry powder or dust insecticide. We can put that down into the opening, leave the opening open so that they come and go through the dust. We may have to do that more than once, but we could treat if we can find the nest opening. Now, if the infestation appears to be the pot and we don't know where that opening is, we really don't have an option. So maybe the thing to do is at night, when we would have made the treatment, move the thing to another part of the yard.
All right. Quite a ways away from the deck.
There you go.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me, Donald Lewis, professor of entomology at Iowa State University. Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. They are here to answer your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nevy. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron and Donald Lewis, Professor of Entomology at Iowa State University. They are here to answer your questions at 866-780-9100. And Judith is on the line next in Coralville. Hi, Judith.
Good morning.
What's your question?
My question is back to the Japanese beetles. I have a huge flower garden around my house. Everybody loves it. I do, too. And I know the lady who keeps bees, and her bees eat in my garden. The beetles have decimated my roses and hibiscus. Is there anything I can put on them besides seven or something that will also kill the bees, that won't kill the bees?
Well, if there's no flowers available for the bees, they're not going to be on those plants that you have treated. So the impact is going to be minimal if we very judiciously apply the insecticide to the leaves where the beetles are feeding, but not to the flowers where the bees might be visiting. That said, you do have a couple of other options that are not going to be toxic to bees, and one of those is called surround, just like we surround ourselves with our friends. We surround our plants with a layer of clay, and it's non-toxic, but it is repellent. So surround spray, it's a dry powder that you mix with water, spray on the plants. That would repel Japanese beetles, but it's not going to kill them. They're still there, they're still in the environment, but on the leaves that are treated after every rain, they'll be less likely to feed. The second ingredient that will also repel Japanese beetles is called neem, N-E-E-M. It's a botanical insecticide that is not poisonous, but it is a growth regulator and it is a feeding deterrent. It will also help move the Japanese beetles off the treated plants so that they have to go to somewhere else to eat. Those two give you some options that you could use in a bee-friendly environment, a brief bee-friendly area, and should have at least some luck protecting the foliage on your plants, but you're going to have to do it frequently.
All right. And the Japanese beetles, if they haven't already disappeared, should be disappearing really shortly, right?
We're at the end of their natural decline. So they're usually here for about 6 weeks. And since they started in the third week of June, we're at the end of that. But there will be this tapering off. And every once in a while, we still see a Japanese beetle into September. But the worst of it should be over for most of the state. Now, I made the prediction earlier that the worst of it was over on the 4th of July, but that turned out to be only so-so correct. So maybe this one won't be either, but the worst of it should be over. And
this is the more traditional time from our previous experience.
Right. This is the time that they would, under normal circumstances and in a normal year, we would expect to see the decline by now.
All right. Well, good luck, Judith. And of course, save those ideas for next year or the year after that. I'm sure they'll be back. Jim is on the line next in Bettendorf. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I planted a 5-acre field in pollinator mix this spring. And in addition to the milkweed that was in the mix, I added a couple extra bits of milkweed. And in that 5 acres, I haven't seen one single milkweed. And I'm just wondering if they take some time to root or do they just not growing?
What you need is a prairie specialist to answer your question at the moment. And this is one of those things I hear them talk about when I go to their conferences and when I'm forced to sit and meet with prairie people. They talk about how there's this spread over time when different things will finally emerge. And it seems like the grasses all come up the first year, and the second year you get a few flowers, and the third year you get a few perennials, and it's going to look like heck for a long time till it establishes. So I think what you're seeing is what they would expect in a prairie seed mix of various grasses and flowers. Not everything comes up the first year, and it's a process. It's a succession of plants that come up over time. Did I get that right, Richard?
I would agree, yeah.
Okay.
Some things come up and they just don't grow much the first year. They're there, but you really don't see them because they're just right above the ground. And what they're actually doing that first year is putting most of their effort into root growth. So above ground, you don't see much, but below ground, they have a nice root system. So then the second year, then they really grow.
All right. Thank you. That's what I was hoping.
All right. Good luck, Jim. Thanks a lot for your call. Next up, we've got Bill in Sac City. Hi, Bill.
Oh, hi, Charity. And thank you for taking my call. And hello to Richard and Donald as well. So thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What do you want to talk about today?
Well, I've had a long-standing concern about monarch butterflies, but not only them, but the all other wildlife, including especially the ground nesting birds that rely on our grasslands so much. But I've been participating in the USDA's Conservation Reserve Program, and I've been doing so and actively working on the land for about 36 years. And what I have observed over time is there's a need for the active management of CRP acres to keep the milkweed and other flowers growing. And what I see in other CRP areas across the state is that without the active management of CRP plantings, they revert back to the common non-native grasses of Rome and Reed's canary grass, which really don't promote very much biodiversity. And what I would like to see the USDA, and for that matter, other landowners that aren't necessarily participating in the CRP, is to promote the programs of prairie burning of existing CRP and to also start interseeding existing stands of CRP with a predominance of flowers in the mixes. Mm-hmm. And I just might add, it's the flowers that promote the insect biodiversity, and it's not the grasses. And so I think the USDA, through their CRP program, they need an active program of education and also financial incentive for landowners to do this on their land. And this is just a comment, and I'd like to see that more actively happen on private lands, and state lands as well, too. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Bill.
Thank you, Bill. You're preaching to the choir here in the studio that we agree. And in fact, the Monarch Conservation Consortium here at Iowa State University is looking at how do we better manage everything from CRP to roadsides to field margins to achieve better biodiversity and to also increase the amount of milkweed, the amount of pollinator habitat, and so forth. So your comments are very well taken, and I think research along these lines is happening. I like your sentence about financial incentives to help this happen, because oftentimes CRP fields get kind of ignored. So I hope you're right. I hope it works out.
Well, and it's also a good note to private landowners who want to create this kind of biodiversity in their land, on their land, that you need to pay close attention to the seed mix you're getting.
Yes, and I believe the Natural Resource Conservation Service, I think they are considering these, and those seeds are now in their mixes where they didn't put very many forbs, they didn't put very many other plants in their seed mixes earlier. So I think things are happening, but probably not as fast as we would hope.
Let's go back to the phones. Kevin is on the line in Kelowna. Hi, Kevin. Kevin, are you there? Looks like we lost Kevin. Dina is on the line in Ames. Hi.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's your question?
I have a question. We're back to butterfly bushes and things of that nature. We have a stand of butterfly milkweed, the swamp milkweed, and we've been having problems in its third year of it dying off. And I'm wondering, is the problem with the dying off because of the drier weather? Is it because they're spraying within about a quarter of a mile in agricultural fields from our edge of Ames? Or if it's just the natural cycle of that particular plant?
Yeah, it's not natural. And it's most likely not any type of herbicide drift. That's too far away. I don't think that's it. Now, the swamp milkweed, though, is pretty demanding in that it likes a moist to wet soil. It is not drought tolerant, and it has been awfully dry this year. And I could see where, if it wasn't watered, that it might decline, because it does like a moist to wet site. So that possibly could be an issue. If you don't have a very good site and it does get quite dry, I would make sure that you water the area maybe at least once a week, and really water it well, slowly and deeply, and that should help quite a bit, I would think. Now, obviously, it could be a disease. That's another possibility. They're not disease-free. They're not pest-free, so that could be a possibility, too. But do make sure it has water during dry periods.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, John in Iowa City. Hi, John. Oh, goodness, that's a terrible noise. I think we've lost John as well. Let's talk to Ernie in Des Moines. Hi, Ernie.
Hi. I had a question, two questions, actually. One of them, the first one is, I have an asparagus patch that I would like to move. Is there a good time or a better time than others to move that?
Okay. How old is the patch? How old has it been there?
5-6 years, probably.
It's probably not feasible to move. And I say that because when you have established plants, they have a huge root system, the crown is huge, and typically what ends up happening is that if you try to dig it up, you damage it so severely that it never fully recovers. So typically we say, if you have an established bed, your best option is to simply buy new plants, because transplanting doesn't work very well. If they were just 1 or 2 year old plants, possibly, but 5 year old plants, they're just too well established.
And the other question is that I have a small raised bed garden. It's only about 8 foot by 8 foot, and it's in three sections. I have a raised, the center is higher than the two sides. And I always get one tomato plant, and
okay,
I try to buy an heirloom tomato each year, and then I move it around so it isn't in the same area year after year. And this year it went tall on me, and it started blooming right away. And I put woven wire around it to keep it together. Well, it went through that, so I thought, well, I'm going to add another section. So I add another. This plant is well over 6 foot tall now, but I've only got 4 tomatoes on it. It's blooming a lot, but not producing tomatoes.
There are a couple of things on that. The heirloom varieties tend not to be as productive as the hybrid varieties. That's one thing. And the other thing is that tomato plants are actually pretty finicky as far as temperatures and blooming. So when the daytime temperatures get above 90 and your plants are blooming, those warm temperatures interfere with pollination. So we don't get very good pollination, and therefore it simply dries up and falls off. We get no fruit. So typically what we want are temperatures during the day, upper 70s, low 80s would be ideal, 60s at night. But when it gets above 90, even though they flower, they're not going to set fruit.
So these temperatures right now are probably
much better.
A good sign.
Much better.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for your call, Ernie. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Here's a question from Nate. He said, we planted seedlings of swamp milkweed and butterfly weed, and lately they're covered in aphids. Should we kill the aphids? If so, how do we do that without making trouble for butterflies?
Well, the aphids have to eat too, and so we could coexist. We can leave them alone. However, the emphasis on the word seedling suggests that the added stress of sap loss to aphids may not be a good thing. So, a couple of ideas. One, stand there and squeeze the stems between your thumb and finger and squash the aphids that way. Second idea would be to use insecticidal soap. You buy this at the garden center. It's a detergent that you mix with water. You only need to spray the stems. It's only going to kill the insects that it hits. So you spray very carefully up and down the stem to kill those bright yellow aphids that are such an attractive part of milkweeds. So tolerate them if you can, squash them if you want to, use insecticidal soap if you need to.
All right, here's a question from Andrea. She says, are all parts of herbs edible? How about the root ball on garlic chives? They look like green onions.
Well, not all herbs as far as the roots are edible, but as far as something like a chive, yes, they should be, absolutely,
right,
because they're a type of onion.
And she goes on to ask, how about veggies, the flowers, the leaves, asparagus fronds?
Well, no, you need to know exactly what you're eating. For example, potatoes. You can eat the tubers, but the actual foliage would make you sick. Same with tomatoes. You can eat the fruit, but you can't eat the foliage. So you need to know exactly what you're eating.
All right. That's just really good advice all around.
Let's not encourage
you. Don't experiment.
Right. No experiments, please.
She also says, I have bad luck with rosemary. It does get very big in the garden, like pictures in magazines. Then she brings it into her heated garage every year and it dies.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's hard to overwinter. Yes. It's a very finicky plant, does well outside, but trying to overwinter it, it's a very difficult thing to do. Sometimes it works, oftentimes it doesn't.
Here's a question from Mary. She says, I've had Japanese beetles attacking my milkweed patch, and I've also had yellowing leaves and spots on the leaves. Is it okay to feed my caterpillars?
Oh, I think so. If there are some fungal spores or some fungal leaf diseases on those plants, the caterpillars are going to eat around those. It's not going to hurt them that way. They aren't going to appreciate leaves that are past their prime, so they like the tender, juicy leaves. They don't want the dead, dried up ones. So there's some point where it's not going to work, but sure, give it to them and see what happens.
And another candidate for a caterpillar relocation service,
sure.
Possibly.
Carefully move it to a new plant and see if it survives there.
All right, and here's a question. Somebody wrote in to say, I have a young peach tree about 3 years old. I noticed two peaches on it earlier this spring. I've protected the tree with wire to keep the deer away. However, the peaches have disappeared. I suspect raccoons because we've seen them in the area. I know they can climb. I'm not sure the wire will keep them out. Any thoughts on the peaches disappearing?
The wire would not keep them out. No, they're very acrobatic, and they tend to know exactly when they're ready to pick. Same with sweet corn. And they're there one day, and they're gone the next. So,
not
much you can do.
Right. And a final question from Josh in Iowa City. Is 7, the Japanese beetle pesticide discussed by a previous caller, toxic to butterflies?
It would be toxic to butterflies if it gets on them. But since we're not spraying flowering plants, we're not spraying the flower part, the butterflies are not going to be exposed to it. 7, also known as carbaryl, is not systemic. It only stays on the plant where you put it. It's not going to be carried through the sap to the other parts of the plant.
All right, and we are out of time. Donald Lewis, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charity. It's always a pleasure.
Professor of Entomology at Iowa State University, Donald Lewis. Richard Giron, thank you.
You're welcome.
Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. We'll be back again next Friday with Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Have a great weekend.